Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Now, in the last couple of weeks on the show, we remembered the great Mary Wilson, who died earlier this month. Mary, she was one of the founding members of the most successful American group ever formed, the Supremes, with 12 number ones on the Billboard Hot 100. Music tastes and styles may change, but one permanent fixture in popular culture over the past five decades is the girl group. Now, Jacqueline Warwick is professor of musicology at Dalhousie University in Halifax in Canada, and she's the author of Girl Groups, Girl Culture, Popular Music and Identity in the 1960s. And Jacqueline joins me now to talk about the evolution of the classic girl group. So thanks for being with us on the programme today, Jacqueline. When did we see the first girl group, as we understand them now, start to emerge?
Well, we can say there's sort of precursors to girl groups that go quite a ways back. I mean, even in the 17th century, there are, you know, Italian composers writing for groups of female voices. But I think it's a really significant thing about the girl groups of the 1960s that this is really a musical portrayal of a truly a girl identity, right? These are teenage girls talking about, singing about the things that teenage girls care about. And that is different from something like the Andrews Sisters or the Boswell Sisters, who are female trios who come from before. So I would say the first girl groups, you know, as such, we start to see them in the late 50s. And the first really sort of mainstream success of a girl group is the Shirelles with Will You Love Me Tomorrow in 1960.
Tonight you're mine completely. You give your love so sweetly. Tonight.
And that's Carole King and Jerry Goffin, isn't it?
Correct. Yeah. So one of the other things that I think is so significant about the girl groups of this period is that the people writing songs for them were themselves teenagers. So Carole King was 18 when she wrote that song, and encountering an unplanned pregnancy and making a decision about, you know, whether she and Jerry Goffin would marry. And that's where how the song came to be. And they wrote it together and then put it into the voices of these other teenage girls.
Well, the 1960s, we all know, is the year when culture just completely and absolutely was revolutionised for a thousand reasons. But when the 1960s came and the door opened for the girl group era, what was it about that that meant girl groups took off?
So, you know, I'm a Gen Xer, right? I grew up in the 80s and 90s. And the story that I always grew up with about music in the 60s was that, you know, everything was terrible until the Beatles. And even the Beatles didn't really get good until about 1966. And, you know, the only women of any value were, you know, Janis Joplin and Joni Mitchell. I mean, I'm being a bit glib here, but I think some people will recognize that narrative. And now I think we do have a different understanding of music in the 60s. I always say, you know, the past is always changing. And we think now about the sort of the early rock and roll and pop music of the early 60s, where girls were very prominent, right? There were these groups, and that they were able to, you know, it was a real forum for girls to sort of try on different identities, share ideas, articulate things that were important to teenage girls. And it's a really significant moment in youth culture and arguably allowed some of those girls who grew up with that music to become feminists as adult women.
Okay, well then, you mentioned the Shirelles, New Jersey. Let's go to Detroit and Tamla. How important was Berry Gordy and all of that kind of thing?
So yeah, obviously very important. So Berry Gordy, you know, a remarkable businessman, musician, great ear for talent, all of those things, builds this extraordinary record label in Detroit. He sees the success of groups like the Shirelles and knows that he wants something like that in his studio as well. So he encourages groups like the Supremes, the Primettes, as they were called when they originally came to Motown. Also the Marvelettes, Martha and the Vandellas, the Velvelettes. There were an awful lot of girl groups who put out records with Motown.
Is there any way at all that the decline of the early kind of rock and roll, the start of the British invasion, did that help? I mean, like, a lot of them were very big in England and then suddenly were very big back in America too. Is that part of it all? I mean, even the Beatles doing Please Mr. Postman and Boys and Baby It's You and all that kind of thing.
That's right, yeah. And they, in fact, on the first two records, the Beatles do more girl group covers than Chuck Berry covers, right? It was obviously very important. And even, I would say, even some of their early songs like You're Gonna Lose That Girl, an original song by the Beatles. That's really sounds like a girl group song, right? It's got that kind of call and response, the sort of finger wagging chorus. Yeah, yeah. It's really got a lot of elements of that girl group sound. So they knew that that girl fans and listeners were very important to them. And so it was important to create music that they would respond well to.
You're gonna lose that girl.
Yes, you're gonna lose that girl.
You're gonna lose.
Yes, you're gonna lose
girl.
That girl.
If you don't take her out tonight, she's gonna change her
she's
mind.
She's gonna change her mind.
And I will take her out tonight, and I will treat her
I'm
kind.
I'm gonna treat her kind.
You're gonna lose that
yes,
girl.
Yes, you're gonna lose that girl.
You're gonna lose.
Yes, you're gonna.
Well, what was, let's go to the West Coast. What was Phil Spector up to in terms of Hollywood and what he was doing?
Yeah, so of course, with Spector's recent death in prison, yeah. we are definitely kind of thinking about him and his legacy. And he, of course, was famous for creating, as a record producer, for creating what he called the wall of sound. And this was a pretty innovative recording technique where he would really, it was really a method of recording the space that was unusual, right? That he would place microphones in unusual places in the studios, and he would really pack the sound, right? So he would, you know, record a bunch of musicians and then mix it down to one track, and then record a bunch of other musicians and mix that down, and then mix it all together. So the effect in the end was this kind of blurry wash of sound that was really dramatic and intense. And then a really key part of his wall of sound was these young girls' voices. And so I think it's important to acknowledge that the wall of sound was the sound of girls trying to be heard, right? I mean, that's really what it was. And it was immensely attractive to fans and important to him. And, you know, the more we learn about his, it's well known, well documented that he was a angry man with a violent streak and quite controlling. And it all kind of, I think we have to think about that when we think about the wall of sound and the girls who worked with him.
Yeah, but the funny thing is, like, you know, he did find, like, with the Crystals and the Ronettes, they did have voices powerful enough to compete with his raucous productions. There's no question about that. But what about, like, for instance, those other types of stuff there? Like, for instance, the Shangri-La's Leader of the Pack and this kind of death disc kind of thing, teenage thing. So what I'm getting to, I suppose, is were the girl groups of the early 60s, were they voices of female empowerment, or were they reflections of traditional female roles?
Right. Well, I'm a scholar, so of course I'm going to say both. It always has to be a little bit more complicated.
Yeah.
I would say that the Shangri-La's were great voices for the kind of teenage drama and angst and melodrama that really is a sincere and true part of the teenage experience. So, you know, their songs are perfect for that moment when you shout at your mother and flounce off into your bedroom and slam the door and throw yourself on the bed, right? Like, that's what the Shangri-La's music is about, is that feeling of adolescent angst and drama. And so, yes, a lot of their songs are wildly melodramatic. Leader of the Pack obviously being the great example, where we actually hear the young man die, right?
Yeah.
We hear the motorcycle crash, and it's really over the top. But as I say, kind of real in a way. And the Shangri-La's are a little bit later than the earlier girl groups, and they they're white, so that's another significant distinction between them and most of the groups. They're an all-white group, and they think of themselves more as rock and roll than kind of pop, and they have this kind of drama and intensity. The Shangri-La's were actually a really important source for a lot of punk acts in the 70s, that they loved a lot of that music and wanted to kind of recreate that mood.
One day my dad said, find someone new.
Okay, by the way, we are talking to Jacqueline Warwick, Professor of Musicology at Dalhousie University in Halifax in Canada, and she is the author of Girl Groups, Girl Culture, Popular Music and Identity in the 1960s. So let's just take a look here, that, like, we're talking about girl groups as such, and that's not the same as girl bands, is it? I mean, like female bands who play instruments, is this a separate phenomenon?
I would say yes. Yeah. With greatest respect for female centered bands, I think the girl group is really deserves some respect, that it's a vocal group. In most cases, the music is written by professionals and backed by professional studio musicians, right? So it's the girl singers are their job is to interpret the songs, to make it believable and sincere and fun, and they do this through their voice and through, you know, matching costumes most of the time, and usually some choreography on stage.
Okay, but did the girl groups of the 1960s open the door for female musicians? Maybe not. And if they did, how did they do it?
So yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think they it was a really important moment where teenage girls were really front and center of mainstream popular culture for a few years in the early 60s. And, you know, at the very moment that, you know, for example, the terrible murder of four little girls in the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, yeah. In 1963, there's a moment where these girls are, you know, very young girls are martyrs. And at the same time, we're hearing records by, you know, the Ronettes, the Shirelles, you know, the Chiffons, all these other groups. And so it is this moment of really thinking about the teenage girl, who she is and what her place is in society. And I think they do, I know they do inform and influence and inspire girls and women who would grow up to become musicians. So they absolutely play a role. But it's unfortunate that for a long time we've kind of trivialized them as, you know, just they're just puppets. All they do is sing and dance. They're not real musicians. I'm very committed to turning that story around.
Well, then, one that you mentioned earlier, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow by the Shirelles, that openly talked about romantic encounters in a much more conservative time. It's hard to see, looking back, just how conservative it was. Were the girl groups pioneers in terms of putting female sexuality into the mainstream?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, there'd been, you know, blues shouters and very quite, you know, frank discussions of sexuality and desire coming from blues singers for many decades. But the Shirelles were, you know, they looked and sounded like nice girls. They were, you know, the girl next door, and they were polite and demure and well-dressed. And then here they are talking in this song about, you know, do I or don't I? And that's quite momentous.
The question of race just cannot be avoided. Groups like the Shirelles and the Supremes appeared in a way to transcend race in a time when relations weren't good. How did they attract white audiences, and was it controversial?
Yeah, it certainly was controversial. So famously, the Marvelettes' big hit, Please Mr. Postman, Motown released it with a picture of a mailbox on the cover on the sleeve of the record, rather than a picture of the group, so that it would be possible for people to buy it not knowing the racial identity of the singers, and also perhaps possible for teenagers to, you know, bring it into their home without their racist parents objecting. So that was a strategy that was necessary. It was deemed necessary by Berry Gordy and others at Motown. But then, you know, a few years later, we get Diana Ross of the Supremes, who is this icon of glamour and elegance and style, admired by girls of all races. So, you know, the 60s is such a fascinating time, and how painfully and really rapidly things shifted during that decade in terms of thinking about racial equality. So, you know, while we might think that the Supremes didn't really sing politically outspoken material, and they didn't, but they were political, right? Their very existence and their success was enormously significant.
I mean, like when you mention it, like the glamour and the sophistication and the respectability, when the Supremes came to London, I mean, they were feted as, like, you know, nobody gave two hoots in some ways about what their colour was, just how great their music was. Isn't that at the basis of all of this? It's just how damn fine the music always was.
Of course, of course. Instead of
Okay, well, then what does it mean in terms of like anything to do with civil rights and Diana Ross at that time? And Mary Wilson spoke about this when we took an interview that we did a couple of years ago on the programme last week. Motown as well, you know, the Berry Gordy had been the assembly line worker. All of this, like, what did it mean in the late 60s in terms of civil rights, or did it mean anything?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Motown was Berry Gordy, you know, set himself the very ambitious goal of, you know, creating this record label that would and did eventually become the largest independent black-owned business in the United States for quite a long time. He held that title. And he also, a lot of people don't know that Motown, he also recorded political speeches. So if you've ever heard any of Martin Luther King's speeches, most of those were recorded by Motown engineers. So that was sort of a side of the business that a lot of people don't know about. But he was pragmatic and cautious, I guess. His goal was to create, you know, the Black Frank Sinatra and the Black Barbara Streisand and you know, to sort of create music and artists who would, you know, be able to perform at Vegas you know, all the sort of the top clubs. But also, you know, he was, you know, along the way creating this music that teenagers loved and that became sort of the soundtrack to their coming of age. So yeah, the impact of Motown Records is hard to understate when we're thinking about people growing up in that time.
Well, if there was a theme throughout all of this era, and just put it down to one word, which is probably impossible, but is that word teen or is that word adolescence?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yeah, I think I like the word teen and teenager. And I think it is, you know, again, I always tell my students that, you know, in a weird way, my parents were never teenagers. They, you know what I mean? Like they obviously they went through those years, but they came of age during the war and they were children and then they became adults. And there was not really the sort of the sense of a teenager as a distinct subject position, right? That needed its own fashion and its own music and entertainment and sort of cultural expression. That's a relatively new idea that really solidifies in the 1960s with, of course, the baby boom generation, who were teens at that time, and they were the single largest demographic. So we really see a lot of focus on adolescence and teen culture during that decade.
Yeah, I mean, like, even though you can go into Rudolph Valentino or Frank Sinatra, etc., but I mean, like, basically a certain age group was meant to be seen and not heard, and suddenly by the kind of late 50s and the Beach Boys and Chuck Berry and black music and everything else, I mean, suddenly there was a whole new subgenre out there, and they didn't give two hoots about what parents were saying in some ways, and they had to be kind of played to, and the music was the one that played to the most. So when you move into now, more recent times, what influences of the 1960s girl groups do you think can still be seen in girl groups today? I mean, I'm talking everybody from En Vogue to Exposé to Sweet Sensation to Pussycat Dolls to Fifth Harmony to K-pop even right up now. I mean, do you remember LaBelle and the extravagant spacesuits they wore and everything?
Yeah.
Where do we go, like, in terms of that? Like, what directions have the Spice Girls and Destiny's Child, if you like, taken from the Supremes?
So, again, you know, the girl groups were, in a way, architects of what a teenage girl identity should look and sound like. And that is a legacy that continues, you know, even to this day. I mean, a lot of the songs might seem a little bit quaint to us now, but really the idea that teenagers, teenage girls, you know, we have these sort of cliches about what a teenage girl is. And, you know, a little bit petulant, dramatic, you know, fun, flirty, you know, all those kinds of attributes. And those really are things that the girl groups built as a kind of identity. So, yeah, I mean, certainly there are many, many, like all the groups that you listed owe a great legacy to the sound of the girl groups. Mm-hmm. But I would say, I mean, I see girl group echoes everywhere in advertising, you know, children's media, you know, like Sesame Street often has like little girl group puppets sometimes. Yeah, and I'm always seeing them pop up. And it's a sort of recognizable shorthand for teenage girl-ness, if I can make that into a noun.
Right, indeed. Well, then finally, like, do you think that they are, or that they were, the girls in these groups, that they were more exploited years ago and maybe more sexually provocative today because the times are more sexually provocative as well?
Well, of course. You know, I'm a glasses half full kind of gal always, but it is, you know, unavoidable that many of these groups were exploited and continue to be. Teenage girls are, you know, not always sophisticated enough and confident enough to speak up for themselves. And many people have taken advantage of that. So especially a girl who, you know, wants to be famous and doesn't necessarily understand everything that goes along with it. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm thinking a lot now about Britney Spears in the wake of this new documentary about her conservatorship and the kind of career that she's had, right? As far as I can see, she was the family breadwinner from a very young age. And yet she couldn't be the head of household because she was a child, right? So it's this sort of weird tension. You know, there's a way in which the teenage girl celebrity, her job is to perform awakening in a way, right? Like there's a way in which they're sort of, they perform sexual awakening for us. And that's what's fascinating and attractive about them. And of course that becomes exploitative. How can it not? And we see it over and over again. It certainly happened with girl group singers in the early 60s. It certainly happened with Miley, with Britney. It kind of happened with Miley Cyrus, but I think she's been quite smart in pushing back. And Billie Eilish, I think has been one of the things that's really fascinating about her is how she has managed to sidestep that whole thing as far as I can see.
Yeah, indeed, absolutely. But in general, finally, I might as well ask, don't sit in the fence with the answer to this one here, because if I mention my En Vogues and exposés and Sweet Sensations and Pussycat Dolls and Fifth Harmony and all the rest of it, if you look back in the 60s, which you say, you know, it wasn't your time, you weren't necessarily there, but wasn't the music from all the girl groups you're talking about the 60s 10 times better than the ones I've just mentioned?
Well, of course I'm going to say yes, because I love that music so much. And, you know, I've dedicated years of my life to listening to that music and thinking about it. So, yes, naturally, it's my favourite. No argument from me there.
Right, indeed. OK, it is Dalhousie University in Halifax in Canada, Professor of Musicology, Jacqueline Warwick. The book is called Girl Groups, Girl Culture and Popular Music and Identity in the 1960s. Jacqueline, thanks so much for being with us on the programme today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.